Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Helen.
And I'm Stephen.
And this is the New Statesman podcast. Stephen, what happened in the Queen's speech, Stephen?
To be honest, not all that much. It was very much a pre-election Queen's speech. With one eye, Cameron knows he needs not necessarily to attract 6 million Labour voters. They're relying on Jeremy Corbyn, John McDonnell and the rest of Labour's big beasts to do that. And John McDonnell gave a speech earlier this week, which kind of did some of the heavy lifting on that. And Corbyn is actually putting himself about a bit more on the European stuff. But they did sort of need something which wasn't so egregious that Labour voters could know that they were voting to keep Cameron in a job and not feel horrified at that prospect. So it was mostly kind of odds and sods. It was fairly thin gruel.
So I talked to an MP earlier who said, on the doorsteps, people, I'm talking to Labour voters, and they don't know Labour are for staying in the EU.
Yeah.
And I think that's going to be a big problem. Okay, so let's run through the conspiracy theories, right? So the conspiracy theory is that John McDonnell is a sort of secret agent for Leave embedded in the Labour Party. How much credence do you give that idea that Corbyn and John McDonnell are really so anti-Europe that they're sort of sabotaging it from within?
So I think that Jeremy and John know that, and actually I think it's... So there are basically two types of people in the Labour Party. There are people who, whether they're socialists, social democrats, whatever group, have basically joined the biggest left-wing party, and they don't have that much affection for Labour as an entity. I would say John McDonnell is that in that group. Tony Blair was very much in that group. Roy Jenkins was in that group. There are lots of politicians which we can put in that group. And then there are people who have a... almost ancestral, even if they're not necessarily people who come from Labour families, but they have a visceral connection to Labour as an entity. Gordon Brown is in that group, Harold Wilson was in that group, Clement Attlee, who was raised a Conservative but very much became part of that group, Hugh Gaitskell, Nye Bevan, and Jeremy Corbyn is in that latter group.
That's an interesting point, because people kind of talk a lot about his... We've now had an updated figure on how many times he rebelled, right, which is under 500. It's
486
maybe. But, you know, the obvious question then arises about why he wanted to be a Labour MP at all. Why not? He didn't stand as an independent. So people then have underestimated his attachment to Labour, even if his idea of what Labour should be doing is very different to everyone else's.
Yeah, and I think with Jeremy, I think you have to understand where he's arrived at on the European question very much through that basis. Yeah, this is someone who still is giving speeches about Europe where he basically goes, we have to back Europe, lists a lot of problems and goes, but we have to back Europe.
Because that's kind of what Theresa May has kind of done as well. Like it's a non-partisan... Well,
Theresa May is balancing party opinion in the other direction. Mm. Theresa May is a pro-European who'd quite like to be elected leader by a anti-European party. So I think Jeremy has, one, arrived at the position he knows he has to in order to keep the party on the road. Labour can be split over... Europe is just a much more fundamental issue to the modern Labour Party than any of the other stuff. And obviously on the economic stuff, there is a quiet...
And as we've
consensus.
Said before, it's one in which he doesn't have the membership on his side.
Yeah. But he has also... And this second part is just a judgment call on my part. It could be completely... I think he has also gone on a bit of a journey in that he is enjoying being feted, actually, by the members of... Labour's sister parties in the Party of European Socialists. They really like him. You know, even people like, you know, Renzi and Valls and Macron, who are effectively, you know, Blairites, like him. Why? Because he's a person from the historical far left who is changing the main Social Democratic Party from inside. He's not trying to kill it from outside like Syriza, Podemos, Melanchthon, all of these others. And when he talks about reforming Europe and changing Europe, they want to change Europe too, because the left is out of power in most of the European Union. And so they can all kind of get together on that. And Jeremy is enjoying finding people who want to talk about the future of the left and talk about ideas, which is obviously his thing. And so I think he is becoming more enthusiastic about Europe. John McDonnell is in that part of the Labour Party, which, as I've said, is kind of cross-dimensional, which views Labour as more of a means to an end. But he also kind of knows, I think, and you've got to put your shoulder to the wheel and fight for. And I mean, because his speech was very interesting. One, because of this clever tactic they've got going now where they are trying to, A, remind Labour voters that Labour is for staying in the EU. But basically, they're talking a lot about a Tory Brexit. You know, if you vote for Brexit, you're not voting for, like, you know, get rid of TTIP. You're voting for TTIP max because you're voting for whatever terrible deal then Cameron or his successor will take. You're voting for a negotiation, a divorce negotiation from a very right-wing government. The interesting thing is the speech is not an argument against the idea that Brexit with a left-wing government would necessarily be the worst thing in the world. But again, it's where they need to be to keep the party together. It's one of my growing listicle of times when Corbyn was more savvy than either a lot of his supporters, who I think like to believe he doesn't do politics.
He's a sort of naive idealist.
Yeah, and his opponents who like to believe that he's like some kind of like guy who's wandered in from the last shower.
When you say shower, do you mean...
That's like a phrase, isn't it? Came down with the last shower? That is a phrase.
Now I'm imagining Jeremy Corbyn as like Donald Duck with a little... Yeah, no, I'm going to evacuate the conversation straight away.
Yeah.
Of the other stuff that was in the Queen's speech then, prison reform is the sort of... Which I think is an interesting one because Michael Gove has kind of carried over his zeal for life chances into this brief, in prison's brief. It's a very liberal-friendly kind of idea that you might reform the prison system. The trouble with it is that I just feel like, much as with the academisation of schools, that some places it will work and some places it kind of won't.
Yeah, and also, I mean, the thing with academisation is that the argument for it, which I think does work in a lot of places, is you've got a fairly clear power base, as it were, which is parents who want to see good outcomes for their children, and they sort of exert the push factor. What is the push factor for these reform prisons, these like prisoners where the governor has a lot of power, to be better at turning out people who... Because, you know, the problem
is the absence, isn't it? Yeah, they'll turn out people who won't offend again, but you don't, no one really kind of gets excited about that.
So what is the push factor? I mean, weirdly, I'm not necessarily saying anything. I don't think this would be a good idea for other reasons. But if, like, they were just turning over prisons to, I don't know, like, you know, Pimlico plumbers or whatever.
Yeah.
And saying, but, you know, we'll give you an NI holiday on however many qualified plumbers you turn out. That, at least as a policy lever, would make sense, because Pimlico plumbers obviously has an incentive to turn
prisoners into plumbers.
I don't really get what the policy lever that a reform prison is meant to be pulling on. There are concerned parents of prisoners, but there aren't concerned parents of prisoners moving in and out of catchment areas to go to the right prison. It just doesn't quite make sense. The other interesting thing is that Joe Johnson and the Queen's speech has opened the door for more marketisation, genuine marketisation in higher education, because now obviously we have a cap and everyone goes at or to the cap because not hitting the cap
on fees.
Is a sign of not being very good.
Why would you say, well, we only charge low fees because actually we're quite crap?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Whereas Joe Johnson wants to have a situation where if you have a good teaching record, you can charge above the 9K cap, which is certainly something to watch for. Labour is going to launch a campaign against it, the name of which a Labour source did tell me, but I am gradually losing my marbles, so much for all those tuition fees. So I can't remember what it's called. And the thing is, so I am a bit of a zealot for the tuition fee
deep
model.
Fees.
No, it's called fees something speech. Like... They're making a point about it being a tax, right? So,
okay.
So I am broadly supportive of the idea that you should have a graduate contribution. It's, let's face it, the only way of taxing the middle classes that we've managed to get the Tories to agree with for 50 years. So, you know, the problem with 9K, you're already effectively at a tax increase on basic rate of about 5p, right? Mm. Which basically means when people talk about the generation without fees, the last generation without fees in 1997 actually paid more net in tax than a graduate on 21k does now because of the way the thresholds have moved. But the second you're raising above that, you are looking at a fairly hefty marginal rate for people entering the job market at 21k, which is when you're eligible. And at that point, you probably do need to have a conversation about what is considered fair, because we quite rightly would go, no, you can't put 9p on basic rate. That is going to have a chilling effect on employment. So that is worth watching. I think we are probably reaching the upper limit of where a graduate contribution is socially just and where it starts to have perverse impacts on opportunity in the job market.
And was there a rabbit?
Not really. It was a fairly unspectacular in every sense of the word Queen's speech. I mean, the interesting thing is, you know, the deficit, I think, was mentioned once.
Do you know what I was thinking? What about that old deficit? I haven't heard a lot about that these last few months. It's kind of amazing, isn't it? I mean, I know we moan a bit about Labour, but the way that I think it's really interesting is, name a Jeremy Corbyn signature policy. You can't. And other thing that people who were really behind Corbyn wanted was a good alternative to anti-austerity. You know, a lot of the energy that the Corbyn came out of things like the People's Assembly, you know, Occupy, the anti-austerity marches. And actually, he hasn't really talked a lot about opposing austerity and about cuts to services. I think that's kind of slightly fascinating. And what it says to me is that Labour at the moment is struggling because it's very reactive, right? Mm. It's defending itself from blows from outside. It's not... At the moment, and maybe this is a thing about, you know, having lost so many people from Brewers Green as was, and new people sort of finding their feet. But actually, in terms of making their own stories, the causes that they were kind of elected to take on, the Corbyn team haven't really started coming up with a sort of distinctive Corbynite flavour of Labour yet.
No, I think partly because the really big loss when Ed left was policy wonks. People like Torsten Eriksson Bell, now at the Resolution Foundation, who had massive brains. From a tactical side, you'll notice if you listen to music radio, you're starting to hear Corbyn's voice a lot more. They're getting much better at that kind of thing. Yeah, his speech today, a bit on the long side, but very funny. And they're starting to get much tighter on that kind of thing. But they still, there's no nice way to say this, don't have a big policy brain worth the name. They have two people who are now leaving who were effectively fresh out of university. There's a policy team at Labour Party's headquarters, which I bumped into one of them on the way home train. I just said, so what is it you actually do at the moment? And they kind of shrugged and looked a bit sheepish and said, to be honest, not all that much.
Yeah.
And that is a big problem. And the difficulty is devolution makes that worse. Because if you know a lot about transport policy, would you rather work for Jeremy Corbyn, where you are going to have to wait 4 years to get your stuff implemented, if you can win? And obviously, you know, lots of things could happen.
Or do you want to go and work for Sadiq tomorrow?
Sadiq
and
tomorrow.
Do something really interesting.
Marvin Rees tomorrow. Yeah. Next year, whoever the mayor of Manchester is, which we should probably talk a bit about the mayor of Manchester.
Go on, let's talk a bit about the mayor of Manchester. I've been out all day, as podcast readers will be able to tell from me going like, so Stephen, if you were a person who hadn't heard anything about, is it Andy Burnham? Is it going to be Andy Burnham?
I mean, he's got a good chance, right? So I've phoned around various Labour activists in the region, and if I could once again do my general call, please do invite me to speak to your local party, because it's how I find out what you all think, and also I'm a great after dinner speaker.
Is that really true?
Yeah, well, I'm okay. But basically, there were two very interesting reactions. There were some people, mainly from the city of Manchester itself, who were like, a Scouser, fudge off. And then there were people from the rest of the conurbate.
I hate the Apple's like clean rating. It's ruining our credibility.
And then the people from the rest of the conurbation, because there are 9 other local authorities, of which I can mostly name 8, so I'm not going to try.
No, go on, do though.
All right, so the 9 others are Wigan, Bolton, Bury, Stockport.
Yeah, I know what I'm saying. Yeah, I don't.
Trafford, Thameside. I've done Wigan already.
Well, if you're an angry Mancunian in one of the two that Stephen...
Rochdale and Oldham.
Oh.
Boom. And the thing is the people from sort of the greater bit of the Greater Manchester Combined Authority are, for understandable reasons, fairly keen on the idea that it should be someone who will be a mayor for all of Greater Manchester. Andy is born in Greater Manchester, is a Greater Manchester MP. Of course, there's the slight awkwardness that he did spend last summer running as, you know...
That Labour leader. We haven't forgotten about that.
The Scouser's Scouser. And,
yeah. What about... Do you know who's a big Labour supporter? Noel Gallagher.
Is he still?
Well, he was. He did talk about... He did an interview with Russell Brand for a special that we ran, and he said he reflected on the famous photo opportunity, saying that was extremely cheesy. But I think he had harsh words for Ed Miliband. Shall we use that euphemism? Harsh words. But I think, could happen.
Yeah.
I might put... Do you know what? Given the state of politics these days, I might just put a tenner on that.
Yeah. I think Andy Burnham is... Yeah, he's got a goodish chance. I think the bookies seem to have made him a immediate favourite. My tip is, if you're looking to make money on it, I imagine Richard Lloyd, who was a Manchester MP, is currently their interim mayor, he's got most of the institutional support in the North West from its power brokers.
Was Ivan Lewis, former minister, he going for Birmingham?
No, he's going for Manchester as well. So Ivan is sort of interestingly placed. I mean, one, there's the chance that Bury, which is one of the North West's genuine marginals, will get more Tory in boundary changes. Two, to be frank, his career is not going places under Jeremy
Something
Corbyn.
Something one might also say about one A. Burnham. I mean, I know he's in the shadow cabinet, but again, as you say, it's that long 4 years until an election, which Labour is not yet hopeful of winning, problem.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is with Ivan is that he is apparently raising a lot of money. The thing I noticed when I was making these calls is every single person I spoke to said, I've seen a message from Ivan on Facebook. And
maybe he's just really he spends a lot of time on Facebook.
Yeah.
Maybe he's doing that all himself.
And he basically has a fairly similar agenda to Richard Lees, who is the mayor of Manchester City. Can I, by the way, just complain about having to write up a story in which everyone's surname ends in L and everyone is in some way running a place which has the word Manchester in the title? It's as bad as the Tooting by-election where all of the candidates are called Khan or are doctors. He's basically running on the, very centralised administration around Manchester. And so he will, I think, do very well in his own seat of Bury and among people from the real city of Manchester.
SNP have got two MPs with the same name, though, haven't they?
They do.
I think what they do on America's Next Top Model is they make one of them change their name.
One of them is...
So McKay, who I won't spoil, but she did very well on a series of America's Next Top Model, actually was Brittany, and there were two... In fact, there were three Britneys, and the one got culled before the makeover round. So just a tip there for any of the people running for the Manchester mayoral race, why not change your name? Okay, I think that's probably all of politics pretty summarily dealt with. Thank you for filling in for the fact that I knew nothing about any of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all for now.
I'm Caroline.
And I'm Anna.
And we host the pop culture podcast from The New Statesman, Seriously.
If you secretly care more about comics than Jeremy Corbyn, this is the podcast for you.
You can find all our episodes at newstatesman.com/SRSLY.
And now it's time to go down the line to the lobby with George.
Hi, Stephen.
Hi, George.
So you had one of the big set-piece parliamentary occasions yesterday, the Queen's speech following Her Majesty's address in the House of Lords. And it was most notable for a remarkably long response by Jeremy Corbyn, which at 41 minutes, including no interventions, was 60 seconds longer than the whole of Sergeant Pepper's. And Corbyn actually started off rather well. He had lots of good jokes. The Tories were amused. He had genuinely won the House over, and it looked as if it could be the moment that he really rose in stature as a parliamentary performer. Unfortunately, when he then moved on to the formal policies of the speech, he did go on rather too long. The Tories completely lost the tension when they weren't mocking him. Labour front benches looked down at their phones, gazed into the distance. And it ended up being sort of mocked, really, by the House.
In terms of the political background, what was Cameron's? Because obviously, it's a speech written in Downing Street. What was Cameron hoping to get out of this Queen's speech?
So I think he had two main aims. The first was to show that the business of government is continuing as normal. Of course, it isn't. The government is in overdrive, trying to ensure that the UK votes to remain when the referendum happens on the 23rd of June. The cabinet is split, but he wants to give the impression, at least, that his mind is still on other matters. And then he wanted a ready-made agenda to pick up after the referendum, assuming it's a vote to remain. And that increasingly is focused on what he hopes will be his legacy, which is social reform. So you had the bill on prisons and courts, a bill to speed up the adoption process, bills to improve access to higher education for disadvantaged groups. And Cameron's strategists emphasise that this isn't a calculated bid to colonise the centre ground. It's a reflection of what he really cares about. And they view it as picking up a project that was interrupted by the financial crash and its aftermath.
Was there anything in the... Yes, obviously, the other eye is it being as non-contentious as possible in order to avoid sinking the referendum. What are the potential flashpoints in the speech for the government, do you think?
The extremism strategy will be criticised by some as illiberal and as potentially threatening freedom of expression. Cameron, actually, in his response to Jeremy Corbyn, made quite a robust defence of that, saying that it was true liberalism to stand up to non-violent forms of extremism rather than merely violent forms. That was the way to defend Western values. The prison reforms are unpredictable. They obviously, some Tory backbenchers view them as excessively soft, but also giving prisons new freedoms enhances the risks of something going wrong and the government having to intervene later. And I mean, more broadly, the risk is with a majority of only 12, with continuing austerity and with the resentment that will linger after the referendum, no item of Cameron's programme is as secure as it would be if he was governing with a much larger majority in happier circumstances.
On the subject of extremism, that has been one area where so far Labour has had a fairly authoritarian line, even under Corbyn. His current Shadow Home Secretary might be going off to become Mayor of Greater Manchester. What do people in the PLP make of that?
I think it's a reflection of the stature these roles have acquired. Obviously, the new Mayor of Greater Manchester will have powers not just over transport and skills and policing, but also over the health service. So in some ways, far more powers than the Mayor of London currently has. So it's, Burnham's decision is clearly partly a reflection of the fact he doesn't regard Jeremy Corbyn as electable. Before Corbyn's election, private remarks of his were leaked, revealing as much. He clearly doesn't think he'll be back in the cabinet in the Labour government anytime soon. And of course, should Burnham win this election, he will resign from the shadow cabinet, and that would free Jeremy Corbyn to move a woman into one of the great offices of state, one of the omissions that was criticised in his first reshuffle. And that in turn could create space to promote a Corbyn supporter to the shadow cabinet, perhaps someone like Clive Lewis or Kat Smith or Richard Bergen.
Well, we'll watch that space and we'll be back next week.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
And now we're joined by John Ellidge of City Metric to talk about, well, this is your other hat. It's not really a hat. It's a crown, which is Monarchy Week, which is on this week on the New Statesman website, which has been edited and overseen by John.
But love a queen, me.
Let's talk about the fact that I think all of us are verging on the Republican, but don't say much about it in public, right? It's not a big cause that you get behind.
I mean,
why is that, John?
Yeah, I mean, it's two things for me. Firstly, it's, I think, you know, all else being equal, I would much rather have an elected head of state, but there are bigger problems to solve. And what we've got at the moment seems basically to work. The other reason that I quite like the monarchy, not the monarch we've got at the moment, the royal family, but the monarchy as an institution, is the same way I quite like the papacy or Doctor Who, which is this kind of long list of weird facts and sort of interesting screw-ups over many years of history. It's just the kind of extent and silliness of it.
Who's your favourite Edward?
Edward the Third, obviously.
The Third Edward, who's changed his appearance following an adventure with a poker.
That was Edward the Second.
Yes, but Edward the Second regenerated after the poker.
Oh, you
were being Terence Dick.
Yeah,
you were being the introduction to a Terence. This is really very obscure already.
The reason I think it's interesting is that republicanism is an incredibly unfashionable cause, right? Even on the left, it's just not something that gets a big head of steam behind it.
I think John's point about how it's just not a priority is part of the problem. So I think the reason why I mostly kind of keep quiet about it is, one, I don't care all that much. Yeah, it's like if I was playing a video game and you were Britain and there was like a thing you could click to be a republic, I would click that button. But mostly just like the kind of people who spend their, like, who actually work for, oh God, I hope not, who works for a republic is listening, is just like they seem so, you know, so cheerless. Yeah, it's like, oh, you know, everyone's having a tombola for whatever royal baby it is now. Oh, you know, that tombola ought to be democratically elected. And just like, we're enjoying our tombola. It's like, I mean, so today, I kind of, you know, she's not a great orator, and which kind of like highlights
this
that
is
she,
the queen.
Yeah, she would not have won any elections. But you kind of don't want to be in the company of those kind of like waspish people who's like think the height of humor is to be like lol, she's old and inherited this.
Okay, I think it's, but this is not specific to Republicans. This is just single issue campaigners. I was at a thing the other day and I was having a conversation with someone about how he's designing an app to do direct democracy. But someone came up and asked us what we were talking about. And they said, oh, we're just retooling democracy over here. And this guy turned to me and went, ah, then you'll be in favor of Brexit, won't you? And it was just blindingly obvious that, you know, whatever conversation you're having, he's going to find a way of getting it in there. And the problem is not that there is anything wrong with being a Republican. The problem is public Republicans are bores.
I also think, I think that actually for the left, I think the Republicanism is to us what bashing the BBC is to the Tories. I think it's something that people who are immersed in left-wing politics basically kind of think, oh, you know, the monarchy's suboptimal, in the same way a lot of Tories think the BBC is this massive market intervention. But if you say that to most people who are not politically obsessed, they go, why don't you like the BBC? Why don't you like Iga Pigel? Why don't you like Her Match?
Day one of the Stephen Bush administration would be to abolish the monarchy, right? Like, I would put it way down my list of priorities. Actually, I would put reforming the House of Lords, because there was a great line from Robin Cook once who said that the only two countries in the world now, democratic countries in the world now, that still have hereditary chieftains in their parliament are Britain and Lesotho. And, you know, I think.
And also now the Eurovision Song Contest.
Hereditary chieftains.
Well, I mean, how do you become a Eurovision judge? Does anyone know? Seriously, if you know, please do tweet me about it. Like, I would love to be one.
To wrench this back to the original premise of the question, though, do you think that the affection for the monarchy will outlast the present queen?
I think it's probably going to depend on how quickly Charles dies. I think, I mean, everyone's giving me looks now. Like, I've just, like, we weren't all thinking that. Like, the whole country isn't thinking that. But, okay, I think Charles is probably going to be silly about the boundaries of his role and probably look, either actually speak out or just look like he really wants to. But I think there is a lot of affection for Prince William. And, you know, Charles is, what, he's 68 now? So he's probably not going to get a very long go.
I don't know. Yeah, to be honest, I wouldn't be surprised if I die of old age before Queen Elizabeth does.
But also, if you look at the historical precedent, it has to be Queen Victoria and Edward VII, right? I mean, he did only get 10 years because life expectancy was much shorter then. But he basically had barely done any... I mean, he did a very small amount of waving. He spent most of his time in a brothel in Paris... You know, and that didn't sink the monarchy.
I mean, no one was doing anything at that point. Like, this is the whole world is kind of stumbling towards World War One unknowingly. It's like, I mean, it's not a great precedent.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I think that the monarchy will. I think if Republic did want to actually start chipping away at it, they would make transitional demands like, you know, why does the head of state give this speech that we know they don't agree with? Shouldn't the Prime Minister have to present to the House of Commons, et cetera, to kind of gently wheedle the monarchy out of public life? But
it's amazing how many European countries still have monarchs, even ones that have invited back their monarchs, right?
Yeah. We were talking about this on Twitter earlier, actually. One of the coolest monarchs I think there has ever been would be Juan Carlos of Spain, who General Franco put in power, basically bequeathed power to on his death. And Juan Carlos pretty much instantly said, right, let's have a constitutional democracy, which is, you know, that's a pretty good thing to do if you're a monarch.
The other cool thing about him is because he was the first monarch in Spain called Juan Carlos, he is Juan Carlos I.
I contribute
a lot to these podcasts, don't I?
But also, like,
in Greece, by the way, their monarchs have letters rather than so. There's a claimant to the Greek throne at the moment called Constantine B.
That makes it sound like a virus.
I thought it made it sound like
or a DJ,
a character in Arrested Development.
Yeah, but the other thing that's really weird is because there's some weird demographic hump or something. You've ended up with a lot of royal families in Europe that have just got 30-something heirs who were quite photogenic and are having babies. But in conclusion, Queen Elizabeth longed to reign over us.
I think obviously the tube line that would be most like the Queen would be the Elizabeth line, which is open coming to a London near you in 2019.
Thank you, John. And now welcome to a section called You Asked Us. What did people or persons unknown ask us this week, Stephen?
So we've actually got a really interesting question from Rob Hunter via the Twitters. Michael Lyons, who is a former chair of the BBC Trust, says the BBC is attacking Corbyn too much. Corbyn supporters are upset that Laura
Kunzberg
is biased against them, but in The Independent, Andrew Grice says Labour is unhelpful / uncooperative with the press. So their question is, his question is, how real is the conspiracy / anti-Corbyn bias, or are Corbyn's people just really bad at doing media, or both, or neither?
I would say it's both, because I think what happens is the BBC, particularly in the time in the run-up to the white paper and charter renewal, has been very worried about making a stink. You know, it went through a really torrid time over things like Savile and various other kind of things, the Newsnight stuff that happened about child abuse investigations. It's really hard for the BBC to break stories. And also because there is this sort of hostility to the idea of them breaking stories from the papers, who kind of feel that's taking away their bread and butter, really. I think one of the problems is the BBC is biased against Corbyn because it follows up the papers, it does paper reviews, you know, the paper open will have a bit where they round up the slots. It will draw its commentators from, the papers. And the establishment is kind of, there's just a lot more anti-Corbyn voices to be had there. So a lot of mainstream Labour and left-wing op-ed columnists, for example, just aren't feeling the Corbyn burn at all. And because it's, you know, and you might say, well, it's because it's a radical grassroots movement, but that means that there aren't nominated spokesmen. And the people who do speak very eloquently don't do very much. So John Lansman, for example, who's one of the founders of Momentum, doesn't do very much. Mm. So, and it's something that we've experienced as well. There are not a lot of pro-Corbyn pundits out there, which is a problem. And also following the papers, and the papers are overwhelmingly, particularly since the demise of The Independent, you've really only got one left-wing paper in The Guardian, you've got one centre paper in The Times, and then you've got The Sun, The Telegraph and The Mail, which have got big readerships and are all right-wing.
Yeah, I also think, to say something slightly ill-advised, seeing as I'm sharing a podcast chamber with my boss, when you are covering a political story, political journalists are weird in that you're colleagues are mostly not your colleagues in the institution you work for. They're people who work for your competitors. So when you're talking about a speech afterwards, there's safety in numbers. So my good friend Connor Pope, who works at Labour List, and I will often sit together at Labour events, and we will discuss what the news line is. Because the advantage is, if Connor and I both miss a news line, well, there's not going to be an inquest, because our main rival for Labour-facing stories has also missed it. So Connor and I sit there and go, oh, what's the news angle? The trick with and obviously that doesn't really matter to me, because we're a very small lefty bubble, and we, you know, are obviously, you know, fairly anti the Conservative Party. But the trick to getting your message out is to effectively make sure that the herd, and again, there is this safety in numbers, has decided that the story is your story. Because Team Corbyn is not that great at cultivating that kind of herd following, they end up in this situation in which people decide that the story isn't their rubbish. And that way they can know they'll all go back to the mothership and go, the story is he's rubbish. And the next day, no one will go, well, you said the story wasn't, he had this interesting point, so-and-so said the story and it was this.
And they don't have any personal loyalty in the lobby to call on, really. I mean, that their press operation are very nice, but Seamus Milne, who's director of comms and strategy, right?
Yeah.
I can't remember exactly what his job title is. Former Guardian columnist. So, you know, he's got good contacts at the Guardian, but actually the new Guardian political editors have taken over since he was appointed. And, you know, that can actually, coming from a newspaper, can be a kind of problem when you're trying to deal with other newspapers that aren't, you know, because you might have made sort of enemies on your way up. And I'm not saying that's purely a problem for Seamus Milne. It was the same problem for Tom Baldwin as well. Yeah. He'd come from the Times and had been a bit feisty in his previous career. So, you know, actually being somebody who comes just from a comms background rather than from a newspaper columnist background can be kind of an advantage there, I think.
Yeah, I also think it's not a style of journalism I do particularly well at myself, but there is a type of journalist who their approach is, I'll be nice about you in exchange for stories. And Corbyn's people have not been very good at cultivating and feeding those people. And I think a lot of people who were very sympathetic to Ed Miliband, who possibly would be more sympathetic to Corbyn if they were having their stomachs tickled a bit more, have become viscerally anti him. Now, you can argue that that is not a fair reaction. Unfortunately, as one of Ed's press officers once said to me, they said, well, you know, the press is like you, there's no such thing as good press or bad press. There's, in the same way, there's no such thing as good weather or bad weather. There's just the right clothing. And the sad thing is for the left is that we do have this problem, and it is always minus 20 and pouring buckets of rain down. Did you see that way?
Yeah, I saw it was a good metaphor. Good, it was almost Raff like in its execution. I think if I were, you know, it would be tough. If I say, would you rather run David Cameron's press operation or Jeremy Corbyn's, it would be a lot easier in some respects to run David Cameron. Well, for two reasons. First is you've got power, you've got things to give away, you've got exclusives, you've got policies, you've got prestige, you've got all the trappings of power that come with it. That gives you more leverage over people. And second thing is you've just got, you know, I think the Tory press was very, very pro Cameron in a way that actually during the election has now made them feel slightly freaked out by how hostile they're finding it during the EU referendum, right? I think you wrote this column a while ago saying that they're finally kind of playing an away game and they're realizing quite what a headwind that is to run into. That said, I think there are things that Corbyn could do better. The leader in the magazine this week says that, you know, he is good on TV. He was good on Peston. He comes across as relaxed. He knows what he thinks and he says it. Ed Miliband often looked quite tortured at the compromises that he was having to make. You know, Corbyn just doesn't he just look serene and untroubled. You know, he knows what he thinks. He loves talking about stuff. You know,
and he's got a very warm voice, which helps.
He's got a warm voice. He's got a really quite a relaxing persona. John McDonnell as well has gone in quite a transformation into this kind of, I was thinking of him as like a sort of boring bank manager. But actually, you know, what, if you're Shadow Chancellor, that someone who kind of looks quite dull and but like they know what they're doing is not a bad look for you. So I think that they could definitely, you know, if they're worried about the fact that they just feel like they just don't get a good hearing from the right-wing press, if the right-wing press is just there to slate them and slag them off, they could bypass that to some extent, not just with Facebook to try and reach younger people, but also by the traditional broadcasters, get them on the sofa. This is what I want. I want Jeremy Corbyn, if he wants to make people care about climate change, which I know is an issue that he cares about, he can do that much more easily if he gets on the One Show and talks about courgettes, talks about how much more it's been raining now, segues that into a discussion about how weather's becoming more wild because we're polluting the atmosphere with carbon, right?
Yeah.
You can do that. It's not. I think people think it's a terrific sellout to do anything fun or lightweight or lighthearted. But if you can give people an insight into you and your values and where you're kind of coming from and make and seem relatable, that then preps them to listen to what you have to say about issues.
Yeah, and the SNP are past masters of this, as indeed was Blair. I mean, Cameron's quite good at it, but it's much easier if you're on the right. You're doing a lot of TV and then doing one interview very carefully chosen with a client journalist effectively. And, you know, that would, I think, probably be the best way forward.
Right. Thank you very much. You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast, presented by me, Helen Lewis, with Stephen Bush. Our producer is India Bork, and our music is Devil with the Devil by the Underscore Orchestra, licensed under Creative Commons. You can find us on iTunes or at newstatesman.com/podcast.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Freddie here. I want to tell you about a new way you can support the New Statesman's independent journalism. Every morning I send out Morning Call, our daily newsletter covering everything you need to know about British politics. It's free to sign up, plus for just £3 a month, you'll get a recommended daily piece of ours sent to you in full, plus exclusive polling analysis from Ben Walker, a weekly update from Will Dunn, and our featured piece on Sundays. If you enjoy this podcast, you'll love Morning Call. Head to morningcall.substack.com and subscribe now.